The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
When Nicole Sandler sits down to do her show, she's the producer, booking the guests, pulling the audio, planning the show, the engineer, running the controls, troubleshooting any problems, playing the sounds, calling the guests, and she's the webmaster, writing the blog, posting the podcast, maintaining the website, not to mention the host, interviewing the guests, explaining the issues, giving opinions, and calling out the bad guys. And then you get the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
The GOP's at it again. Come on. They're going at our rights, picking stupid fights, but there isn't any doubt why they wanted to find gender down the line. Makes me want to scream and shout about women they don't care. It's just so they can share their misogyny and their transphobia, ranting how it's good to look under the hood to prove you're women, they'll disrobe ya. The worst thing about all these right-wingers is their obsession with our bodies and our sex lives. Oh, oh, boy, they're totally crazy about who's a lady. What nerd these purrs, oh, oh, boy, but they want disparage underage marriage. Oh, oh, boy, it's none of your biz, yeah, what someone is, yeah. And gender's not sex, it's more complex. Oh, oh, boy, let people be free, yeah. And who cares what you feel, ah, about who's a woman. Marjorie Taylor Greene says she knows what it means. We're women if our husbands own us. We gotta procreate and act completely straight. We only count if men can bone us. Cause of what a woman is, you can't say. How you gonna take her rights away? Oh, oh, boy, watch their digression from their own question. Lives about ribs, oh, oh, boy, if they prevail, it'll be the Handmaid's Tale. Oh, oh, boy, telling off smackers about tallywhackers. Pronouns we use, partners we choose. Oh, oh, boy, a woman's a woman if that's how she identifies. Man, stop obsessing about who gets to be a woman. We know why you've done what you've done. You got nothing else on which you can run. Knock it off already. Come on, people. Stop obsessing about who gets to be a woman.
Lauren Mayer, stop obsessing about who gets to be a woman. That's our pal, Lauren Mayer. You can find her on the YouTubes. I thought we'd start the week with a song, with a fun song, because there's not a whole lot more fun to be had. Man, things are weird out here in the real world. So, you know, I'm in South Florida, right? I'm in Coral Springs, Florida, which, you know, if you're new to the show, it's right next door to Parkland. In fact, Parkland and Coral Springs are sort of sister cities, if you can call them cities. We share a police and fire department. So we are, in fact, when the shooting happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, it was the Coral Springs Police Department that showed up. Not that they did a whole lot of good, because 17 people were killed, another 17 wounded. And when you hear about the people who are wounded in these mass shooting attacks, you're not hearing the slightest bit of it, because not speaking for them, speaking for myself, some of those injuries are so severe that if it were me, I might rather be dead. Because when a gun fires a bullet from an AR-15, those bullets hit and explode. They are not let me repeat, not the ideal weapon for, say, deer hunting. Though, who would want to kill Bambi? Because they shatter. They're designed to inflict massive damage. And I bring this up for a few reasons. One is, is Lauren Mayer on Twitter? Yes, she is. At Lauren Mayer. Just try that. Let me share this with you. The shooter in that shoot, and I won't say his name. I know his name all too well, and I don't say it. But he pleaded guilty. So you would think that, okay, good. That avoids the need for a trial, right? Wrong. Because they are now going through the voir dire process, you know, the process of picking a jury, even though he pled guilty. What the jury is for the sentencing phase. And this is unbelievable. They're estimating that the jury selection process will take at least a month through the end of this month. And then the trial itself, just to determine whether or not he gets the death penalty or life in prison without parole. Those are the two choices. They're saying the trial is going to last 6 months. So let me read to you from the local newspaper. Today is Broward County, Florida. The Broward newspaper is the Sun Sentinel. A judge dismissed an entire panel of 60 jurors Monday afternoon today after too many became visibly upset at the prospect of deciding the fate of the Parkland mass shooter. 8 potential jurors, 7 women and 1 man, were escorted from the courtroom when they could not contain their emotional reaction to learning they might be picked to serve on the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting case. With the confessed killer in the same courtroom just a few yards away, one prospective juror after another left in tears. The first woman to leave could be heard loudly crying as soon as she left the courtroom. Subsequent jurors held back tears or sniffled, their faces distraught. The shooter himself, who this newspaper article does name, but I won't, appeared to have an emotional response to this display. Aw, dropping his head and looking away from the panel momentarily before facing them again. Judge Elizabeth Shearer said she'd dismiss the pool of 60 jurors who could still be used in other trials and start fresh. The raw emotion had tainted the jury pool, she said. While this wasn't the first time potential jurors let their emotions get the best of them in this shooter's presence, it was the most extreme case. Before Tuesday afternoon, Shearer was able to keep the process moving by having emotional jurors removed in question later in the day outside the presence of other jurors. So here you go. This current trial is now in its fourth day of jury pre-selection. The upcoming trial, scheduled to run through the summer, is to determine whether a jury will recommend a sentence of life in prison or death for this sorry excuse for a human being who pleaded guilty to 17 counts of first-degree murder and 17 counts of attempted murder in connection with the Valentine's Day 2018 mass shooting. A new panel was brought into the courtroom less than an hour after the earlier one was removed. I can picture the scene, and I'm thoroughly disgusted by it, as you should be too. Let me share this with you. So today at the White House, Joe Biden spoke about guns, and I know at least the father of one of the kids who was killed on that day at that school is in D.C. today to hear Joe Biden and his new announcement. But let me tell you, before we get to that, what this week was like in shootings in the United States of America. We should change our name, the United States of Guns, because that's what we are. Just a few random acts of violence from around the nation from this weekend. In Washington, D.C., Saturday night, 4 people, including 2 teenagers, were shot after a baseball game. Nice. In Illinois, 6 people were injured in a shooting in a residential neighborhood. Because What else do you do? In Indianapolis, six were shot, one killed at a shooting at a birthday party. Because what's a birthday party with at least one killed? Two people were also killed and 10 hospitalized after a, quote, targeted attack at a Cedar Rapids nightclub. This is just a regular weekend in America. And I promise you, there were many more shootings than that little roundup that I just read for you. So, what's happening in D.C. today, or happened a little earlier this afternoon, is President Biden announced a new firearm regulation to contain the use of those privately made weapons known as ghost guns. They're unregulated, they're untraceable, and they should not be available. So I don't know what Joe did. I just found the video. I haven't had a chance to even review it, but this went on today.
Congress to pass universal background checks.
Oh, yeah, we do. Yeah, we do.
Universal background checks. And I know it's controversial, but I got it done once. Ban assault weapons.
You got it
done. High capacity magazines.
Yeah.
I was getting criticized when I first passed this law when I was a senator. And guess what?
What?
I was down in southern Delaware to do a lot of hunting and fishing down there. And I was walking up one of the creek beds. And the guy standing there said, "You want to take my gun?" I said, "I'll take your gun." He said, "Well, you're telling me I can't have more than X number of bullets in my gun." And I said, "What do you think the deer you're hunting are wear Kevlar vests? What the hell you need 20 bullets for?"
Good question.
It must be a hell of a terrible shot.
Yeah, no shit.
I'm serious. Think about it. Think about the mass shootings. As many as 100 rounds.
Amazing.
It's a weapon of war.
Yeah.
There's nothing to do with recreation. Outright ban of the sale and possession of unserialized guns. Eliminate gun manufacturers' immunity from liability. They're the only outfit. They're the only outfit in the country that is immune. Imagine had the tobacco industry been immune to being sued. Come on.
Come on, man. All right. Well, you know, nice that he's talking about it, because that's more than we usually get from Washington, D.C., because they just ignore it. Look, after 20 first graders were murdered, were shot down, were massacred in their classroom, and nothing happened, that's when I knew we were done. This country is like the Wild West for weapons. You have a gun? Have at it. All right. Well, somebody's calling. Let's see. All right. Let's answer the phone. Hi. Hi. Who's this?
This is Proudskell in Alabama.
Hey, Proudskell in Alabama. How you doing?
I am doing fine. We are an armed madhouse all over the country.
Yes, that we are.
And unfortunately, the Don't Say Gay law passed in Alabama.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding?
Yes.
That's insane.
And to add insult to injury, my own representative voted for it, and she is a former public defender.
Oh my God. I don't understand.
Yeah.
I really don't understand.
Unfortunately, we only have in our legislature at the Democratic caucus, we only have three white members.
Whoops, hold on 1 second. I'm sorry. Yeah, you only have three white members in your okay.
That are Democrat, and one of them is gay, and he represents the south side of Birmingham. In particular, a number of neighborhoods there are the most liberal ones in Alabama.
Wow. Well, that's Alabama. Look, you know, I hate to say it. This country is so divided, and you know what you're going to get based on the state. We're so polarized. Either it's a red state or a blue state, and there's really nothing in between.
And just to say how crazy, gerrymandering is. I know you're not completely thrilled at my Congresswoman Terry Sewell, but she's the only Democrat in Alabama in Congress. And she, her district is really drawn up strangely. It represents part of Montgomery, what we call the Black Belt, and Selma and Tuscaloosa. But going from Tuscaloosa to Birmingham, where she represents some people there, the district's drawn very strangely. Her border lines follow I-20 from Tuscaloosa to Birmingham.
Okay.
And
you're speaking great to me. I've never been in Alabama, and honestly, I have no reason to ever want to go there. I wouldn't feel safe because I'm Jewish. I think the prejudice is so strong. Proudskill, let me ask you, have you lived in Alabama your whole life?
No, for 40 years. Before that, I lived in California, and my dad worked for the UC system. So I was enlightened before I came here.
So what makes you stay there?
Unfortunately, my dad's job, and then I couldn't get out after he died. And I like how you talk about media consolidation and problems with broadcasting deregulation, because it hits small towns more than large cities. And I'll give you examples, because I worked in media here in Tuscaloosa. By the way, newspapers are being hit hard,
big time.
Staffing.
Newspapers don't exist anymore. Local papers are dying, and the ones that still exist are being bought up by hedge funds that don't care about the news. Yeah. Okay.
There are only staff members of five right now. And in broadcasting, local news, of course, and high school football and weather used to be staples.
Right.
Guess what? They're not covering them in small towns.
Right. Yeah, because there's no news anymore. No local news.
You know, it's just a shame. And thank you for keeping us abreast of things and your music shows, especially because I was a college DJ here. And I remember some of your artists and playing them.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoy them. I don't do them very often, but to make them special when we do them. Right. Proudskill, thank you for calling. I guess I give you props for staying in Alabama. I won't even drive through there. So, you know, there are certain parts of the country I will not go. And that's one of them.
I feel the same way. I was raised Catholic, so it's scary for me.
Well, but there you are.
All right. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. Bye, Proudskill. All right. So, let me tell you about another story that's in the news today that I just woke up to. And it's one of those things with so much going on that we're not going to hear a lot about. What?
You had to have driven through Alabama.
What? Pick up the microphone. What?
You drove back here from New Mexico, didn't you?
Yes, but
you
maybe.
Had to have driven through Alabama.
But I probably didn't stop, and I
was through it for
an hour.
No, it was more than an hour, but nonetheless, you had to have driven through Alabama and Mississippi.
Okay, but I didn't stop there. I wouldn't go there.
I understand.
Okay.
You wouldn't go there on purpose.
Thank you. Okay. So you just had to come in to say that to me, huh? Oh, it's one of those days. Okay. So this story is not going to be heard about because we're dealing with a war, massacres, inflation, a crazy Republican Party who's freaking out over, you know, oh my God, a dude wants to be a woman. So things like this go under the radar. Now, you might recall back in during the big Black Lives Matter protests that when was it? June of 2020. There was a protest in Buffalo, New York. Now, for those of you watching on the video, I'm going to play a video to remind you of what happened when, again, there was a Black Lives Matter protest. As far as I could tell, it was peaceful. And a man, 75-year-old man named Martin Gugino, tried to get the police who were coming with their riot gear and batons and helmets and everything to get them to sort of back down, thinking he could talk to the police because isn't that what police are supposed to do? So let me remind you with this video, this is what happened on that day in June of 2020. You see this old man, he's tall, but he's old, going up to the cops. And he's talking to them. He's talking peacefully. And one of the cops pushes him. And he goes down. And he's down. And he's bleeding from his ear. Right? And the cops are just standing around, walking past him. Nobody's doing anything to help him. Right? And the guy's lying on the street, bleeding.
Back up. Back up. Back up.
Back up.
Let's go and get back.
Okay, so the cops are doing their cop thing.
We have EMT on scene.
You have EMT on scene? Where are they? All right, so just to remind you of the incident. So that's what happened. That man, 75-year-old veteran, Martin Gugino, was shoved by these officers, Robert McCabe and Aaron Torgalski, in downtown Buffalo, as crowd control officers in riot gear cleared demonstrators because there was an 8 o'clock curfew coming up. So it's not that they were doing anything bad. They were trying to clear the area because there was a curfew at 8 o'clock. He was pushed backward, started bleeding after hitting his head on the pavement. He spent about a month in the hospital with a fractured skull and brain injury. Well, on Friday, an arbitrator, not even a judge, an arbitrator wrote, quote, "Upon review, there is no evidence to sustain any claim that respondents, also known as police officers, had any other viable options other than to move Gugino out of the way of their forward movement." Excuse me? They pushed him. He went backwards and fell and hit his head hard enough to fracture his skull and have a brain injury. And they're saying this arbitrator said the level of force used by the officers was justified because Gugino refused to comply with the orders to leave the scene and was acting erratically and walked directly in front of McCabe, the cop, said the other cop. We saw the video. He was talking to them. He was trying to reason with them, saying this isn't necessary. But he wrote, "The use of force employed by respondents reflected no intent on their part to do more than to move Gugino away from them." Are you fucking kidding me? Come on. These two cops were suspended without pay and arrested within days of the incident, but last year, a grand jury declined to indict them and charges were dropped. And now an attorney for this 75-year-old man who has sued the city told the Buffalo News that the ruling has no bearing on the lawsuit. He said, female attorney, Melissa Whiskerhalf, said, "We are not aware of any case where this arbitrator has ruled against on-duty police officers." Let me let that sit there for a moment. We are not aware of any case where this arbitrator has ever ruled against on-duty police officers. So his ruling here on behalf of the police was not only expected by us, but was certainly expected by the union and city who selected and paid him. Justice for all? Where it says, and justice for all. Really? It says that in our Pledge of Allegiance. Where is the justice? Police Commissioner Joseph Gramaglia said in a statement, he'll reinstate the two officers to duty on Monday. That's today. Email messages seeking comment were left Sunday with an attorney representing the city, which argued for the disciplinary charges with the Buffalo Police Union. This is justice, such as it is in this country. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I just don't get it. And over in Ukraine, My goodness. You know, on the one hand, we hear, oh, Putin's pulling back out of Kyiv and the western areas, but he's doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on in the east, on the port cities. Larissa Alexandrovna, who was on with us a few weeks ago, who was born in Soviet Ukraine, and her family escaped when she was 8 years old, posted on Facebook the other day, yesterday, oh my God, Odessa is burning. Odessa is burning. Well, President Zelensky was on 60 Minutes last night. I don't know if you heard him at all. I only saw half of it. We're going to watch it tonight, so I can't really tell you, except that he is, you know, it's amazing the job this man is doing. When you figure, especially when you look at the world he came from, but this man is brilliant. I mean, he's a lawyer. He's a scholar. He's a an economist, I believe, and got famous as a comedian and an actor. And now he is the president of Ukraine. Well, he said today, speaking to, this time he was talking to the General Assembly or the National Assembly of South Korea, because Zelensky has been doing his thing with world leaders and legislatures around the world trying to get support. I mean, I know we're not doing nothing, but when you hear that on Friday, they bombed a train station that was being used to evacuate people. There were an estimated 8,000 people in this train station. And I don't know if you've heard this or not. One of the, you know, there's debris left in the wake of the bombs falling. And there was a big piece of one of the missiles that fell. And on it was written in Russian, "For the children." For the children? And we were disgusted when we saw that they intentionally bombed a building that was labeled in giant letters in Russian, "children," because they're sending the bombs for the children. They're also raping the children in front of their mothers, and they're raping mothers in front of the children, and they're raping elderly women. These, I can't call them people. They're fucking animals. And what President Zelensky told the National Assembly of South Korea in a video hookup this morning is that tens of thousands of people have been killed in Mariupol. Now, we saw the other city that I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. That was just total destruction and bodies everywhere, lying in the streets, in ditches, mass graves. We saw they leveled that city. But we know that they had been hitting Mariupol for probably 3 weeks, unrelenting, starving the people that were left there. And here's a quote from Zelensky. He wrote, "The Russians completely destroyed Mariupol and burned it to ashes. At least tens of thousands of Mariupol citizens must have been killed. Tens of thousands. But for Russia, Mariupol is just an example. Ladies and gentlemen, we've seen a lot of destruction like this in the 20th century. Bucha, thank you. Yeah, that's the name of the city. And for all we know, they were only there for a few days, and we saw the destruction that was left there. Tens of thousands. And yet, the West, and that includes us, is saying, well, we can't go in there and provide any more, you know, whatever, because then it would seem like we're waging war on Russia and that would start World War III. Well, Putin's already said he considers he's already at war with all of us. You really think that if we don't get in further involved, if we don't help them stop this carnage, that'll keep Putin from launching a chemical or nuclear attack? But if we do it, that would set him off? I'm sorry. That's absurd. I get not wanting to start a nuclear conflagration. Believe me, it's the last thing I want too. But I can't hear these stories of the children being raped, their teeth pulled out These are war crimes. Zelensky said that too, and it's true. These are war crimes. Here's one clip from 60 Minutes. Zelensky, you'll hear him and you'll hear the translator talking over him.
What evidence is there of war crimes across Ukraine?
The Ukrainian Security Service has intercepted communications, he told us. There are Russian soldiers talking to their parents about what they stole and who they abducted. There are recordings of Russian prisoners of war who admitted to killing people. There are pilots in prison who had maps with civilian targets to bomb. There are also investigations being conducted based on the remains of the dead.
Should Vladimir Putin be prosecuted for war crimes?
Look, I think everyone who made a decision, who issued an order, who fulfilled an order, everyone who is relevant to this, I believe they are guilty.
Do you hold Putin responsible?
I do believe he's one of them.
Believes he's one of them. That's Volodymyr Zelensky being very generous. I believe he's one of them. So for those of you who've asked about our friend in Ukraine, Tanya, we stay in touch, not as often as we used to. She is in Dubai with her sister. I got a nice message from her sister today, you know, who's got mixed emotions because she lives in Dubai, a very wealthy city in the United Arab Emirates, a very wealthy country. And a lot of Russians are leaving Russia and going to Dubai and buying apartments. They want to escape Russia. And she said she's got mixed feelings. She doesn't want to, you know, help the Russians, but she realizes that, well, at least they want to get out of there, so they can't really be in favor of what Putin is doing. So, you know, she's working with them, and it's her job. But anyway, I'm putting together a care package of sorts to send to Tanya. So I have a faux stained glass thing that I made her with sunflowers. Our friend Joy in the chat room sent a set of her sunflower necklace and earrings that I will enclose there. If you would like to enclose a note, here's what you can do. Send it to me, email me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com, and write a note to Tanya. And I will print them out and put them in the package. It's not cheap, by the way, to send a package to Ukraine to Dubai. So I just want to do one. So and if anyone wants to pitch in to pay for the postage, that's cool too. But if you want to send a note, this is Tanya, our friend from Kyiv. She owns the Friends Forever Hostel in Kyiv, and we've been in touch now them leaving Kyiv and going to this little village where a friend with her husband and 3-year-old little boy joined them. And after a few days, after a week or so, when the bombs started falling there, the men insisted that the women and the little boy leave, and they went to Poland. And I'll tell you, Tanya has been really freaking out because she said in the 10 years they've been together, they haven't been apart for more than 15 days. And yet, you know, she felt guilty when she went to Poland and he was stuck there. Well, now her sister sent plane tickets for Tanya, her friend, and the little boy, and they're now in Dubai. But Tanya she sends me these messages. And first of all, as you can imagine, she's incredibly depressed. She said all she does is cry. She doesn't understand how people can just go about life as if there's nothing happening because she's in Dubai, far removed from Kyiv. And that's where her life is. She said her husband did go back. Their hostel, the Friends Forever Hostel in the middle of the city, is still standing, as is their home, which is a good thing. She wants to go home, but she can't. So again, I'm sending her a package. If you want to include a letter, a note, something, send me an email. I'll print them out and I will enclose them all and we'll send her a nice little care package over there. Okay, now let's talk about what's happening here. And to for that, you know, I try not to call on him too often because I know how busy he is. But David Dayen is the executive editor at The American Prospect. You find them online at prospect.org, at The Prospect on Twitter. David Dayen, thank you so much for joining us. You're executive editor of a real one of the best news magazines out there, in my opinion. With so much going on, how do you decide what deserves covering? Because, you know, my head spit. I don't even know what to talk about on any given day because there's so much happening.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, our North Star is really to talk about power and who has it and what they're doing with it. And so any story that really plays within that space is something I want to write about. We recognize that we're a small staff. We're 14 people.
Wow.
We don't have the ability to talk about every single thing that's happening. And so you have to pick your spots and you have to find ways that you can be valuable to the consumer.
Right. You know, and I came to that conclusion a while ago. I used to freak out, especially in the early days of the former guy's administration, because there was always so much. I mean, my analogy was they just threw all kinds of shit against the wall to see what stuck. And the media couldn't keep up. And I realized it's like I need to focus on just a couple of issues because if I try to cover everything, I'm going to lose my mind even more than I already have. So, and that continues because no matter which way you turn, there's so much. I mean, there's what's happening in Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. There's the American right and what's happening with them. And the fact that, you know, just the story from Friday that they acquitted two of the guys who were allegedly attempted to kidnap Governor Whitmer. They acquitted two and they deadlocked on two. And there were two more who actually pleaded guilty because they were guilty. And they're going, oh, God, we screwed up. I mean, that's going on, which doesn't make me feel real confident about our government's prosecution of these other people who have gone against the government. You know, things like that, inflation and global warming and everything else. So what is your big story in the current issue? What's your lead story in the current issue of the American Prospect?
Well, our most recent issue, which we just put out over the last 2 weeks, we actually did a bunch of profiles. And, you know, in a time when it's very easy to focus on things that aren't happening, very easy to focus on things that are dysfunctional, we tried to find a few silver linings. So, you know, I profiled Rohit Chopra, who's the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and I think a very underrated figure in Washington, in terms of someone who actually knows how to wield the levers of power to get stuff done. And this is someone who throughout his career until CFPB has been in kind of a bunch of thankless jobs. Hmm. He was the student loan ombudsman at CFPB, which was a nothing job on paper. It didn't have really much authority at all, but through his leadership, that probably got the entire student loan crisis issue onto the national radar screen and to the point where now for the last 2 years, we have had paused payments and we may be looking at cancellation of student debt. And I really think he's an instrumental figure in that.
Okay.
Then he goes to the Federal Trade Commission under Trump, where he's outvoted. Republicans have a majority on that commission. Seemingly, he's there to just sort of placehold and dissent. And yet, he transforms that agency. He gets things passed despite being in the minority. Things like new enforcement of made in the USA labeling, these companies that were scamming by claiming they were made in America when they weren't. Doing the Facebook lawsuit, which was his brainchild, something he had worked on for years, and he got a Republican-led FTC to sign off on it. And now you have the point where, you know, everyone knows Lina Khan,
right?
And she's now the new head of the FTC. But not only Lina Khan, but everyone in the top leadership of the FTC right now worked for Rohit Chopra. Even Lina Khan was his counselor in 2018. And so his legacy is creating this FTC that we see today that's very strong. And now he's taking that over to CFPB and working pretty hard, already making progress on things like getting companies to stop, big banks to stop doing overdraft fees that really punish the poor for not having enough money, and other various actions. So I think, I mean, that one I went into detail on, but we did a bunch of other profiles mm-hmm. on, I think, pretty worthy subjects. And it just shows you that if you have not just the will, but the strategic sense to know how to use the authorities that you have, that you can really make a difference in Washington.
You know, and I was happy. I was happy to see that one of your other profiles was Lucas Kuntz, who's running for the Senate from Missouri to replace Roy Blunt, who's retiring. So it's an open seat. And he's awesome. He's a progressive who served three tours of duty. He's been on the mm-hmm. show a number of times. He's great. What freaks me out, though, is, you know, it's like the Democrats are doing the same old thing. They're looking for a Claire McCaskill clone to put up against him. And Lucas Kuntz could win. I mean, I think he's really well positioned. And, you know, I don't know.
Quite literally a McCaskill clone. So they found the day of the filing deadline, they found this lady, Trudy Valentine Bush, who is the heiress to the Anheuser-Busch fortune.
Oh, my God.
You know, the main story that I saw from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the only kind of affirmative, resume items on Valentine Bush's agenda was that she's raised a lot of money for Democrats.
Oh, my God.
That's it. That's all I saw. And so in a race where especially if Eric Greitens ends up winning the primary on the Republican side, given all of his problems with affairs and
domestic violence and
domestic violence and whatnot, and yet he's still effectively tied for the top slot on the Republican side. So if he wins, Kuntz really does. I mean, that seat suddenly becomes a contestable seat.
That's right.
But against someone like Trudy Valentine Bush, I'm not sure that she's willing or able to capitalize on that. And we just thought it was an interesting race because of Kuntz is kind of playing out an argument here that has not really been fully tested across America, which is, you know, can you win on a fully populist message that talks about the elites that have come in and violently kind of imposed markets on states like Missouri. I mean, the intro to that, and it was written by our writing fellow, Lee Harris, who's tremendous. The intro to that piece was about a small town in the boot heel of Missouri called Hite Heights. And this town has the mayor of the town has to go around every day and use pumps to get the sewage system to work.
Oh, my God.
It's like, and Lucas was struck by saying, like, this is what I used to see in Iraq. This is what they used to do. And here it is in the boot heel of Missouri. And you just see this, you know, the substandard living arrangements going on in large sections of our country and the inequality that exists. And someone who actually speaks to that and says, we need to Marshall Plan the Midwest. Mm-hmm. We need to bring our money, resources, and talent back to this country. It would be interesting to see what kind of traction that would get, even in a state like Missouri, which has been trending away from Democrats for 20 years.
Right. Well, and again, he'd be easy. But why the Democrats keep shooting themselves in the foot? Why put up somebody against you've got a great candidate who's breaking through? He's cutting through. He's making inroads. So bring in someone. I don't get it. Another story that is big this week, and I noticed you wrote about it, has to do with unions. The rise of labor, and we had a big vote last week. Well, in Amazon, although in Alabama, was it Alabama, voted it down again. But in Staten Island, New York, a union, what do they call it? The Amazon, Amazon Labor Union, yeah. Amazon. Mm-hmm. So a new, you know, group that they came up with. One. So this is. Are we entering a new labor time? A new time of like organized labor in this country? I hope.
Well, Amazon is appealing this decision, and that's to be expected. But I'm not sure that they'll be successful with that. I think it's a really important, salient moment in the history of unions in this country. We'll have to see how it progresses. But we've already, in parallel, we have the Starbucks Workers United,
yes,
who have won 18 out of 19 elections for Starbucks locations. Now, that's a drop in the bucket, right? There's a Starbucks in every block. There
right.
are about 6,500 of them in the country.
But
we
still,
have 18 unionized
18
shops.
Of 19, that's a trend, right?
It's a beginning. And what I think interesting, particularly on the Amazon side, is that you had an independent union that was not affiliated with any other, any large union effort of the last century. You have they only took out the bare minimum of signers to say they wanted to join a union so that they could get it through by design, because turnover at Amazon is something like 150% per year in these warehouses.
Right.
So if you get 30%, you better hand in those signatures, because otherwise, you know, those people will leave and suddenly 30% won't be 30% anymore. So they did the bare minimum, and then they organized within the workplace and used tactics that in some ways were old, but hadn't been used by traditional organized labor in a long time to really present their case. And I think the fact that they were an independent effort help them, because the traditional case that companies make to say you don't want the union is that the union is a third party, that they're coming in and imposing themselves on this wonderful relationship between employers and employees that we have. Here was a homegrown effort where you didn't have the ability to demonize and say that there were these outside interlopers coming in and stopping the thing. And it neutralized the main message that is used by employers. And I think it was really successful and really interesting. You know, it's going to require a lot of resources, because winning the union is the first step. Then you have to get the contract.
Right.
And so it's, you know, there's a long way to go here in some sense. And they're going to need resources and support to do that. We have a piece today by John Hyatt, who was the former general counsel of the AFL-CIO.
Not the singer-songwriter, John Hyatt.
The singer,
other John Hyatt. Got it.
Former general counsel, former chief of staff, who says that that the labor movement needs to support in a big way, with a full commitment, the work of self-organizing unions. And I think it's a really interesting proposal that he puts together, and says that this is integral to the future of the labor movement.
Great. It is encouraging, because we've gone through a decade of a sort of a downturn in union participation and membership, and new unions being formed. And it seems like something changed, maybe during the pandemic, when we started focusing again on salaries and pay inequity. Is there something there?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the pandemic sort of shined a light on the conditions at particularly low wage workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen all over the country walkouts, people protesting the fact that they don't have enough PPE, or that they had to work in you know, potentially hazardous conditions. Am I going to risk my life so that somebody gets a $10 pair of tube socks? You know, I mean, the idea, I think, is that there was a chance for particularly workers at the low end of the scale to reassess. And that was bolstered by the fact that we have a very hot labor market, that if you don't like the conditions of the job that you're at, that you can find another one pretty easily. And that created, I think, a lot of the tinder to allow something like this to happen. because there was less fear on the part of the workers. There was less of a sense that they needed to have this job and keep this job for their near term livelihood. And so I do think the pandemic played a role here, as it has in previous pandemics. Actually, we've seen there was a study, and I wrote about this in my big piece about why people were quitting their jobs. Mm-hmm. By the way, a disproportionate number of those people quitting jobs, and we're at record levels over the last 50 years. Disproportionate number at the low end of the wage spectrum. And I read this paper that looked back at 15 pandemics across history, going back 1,000 years, wow. Right? And every time the worker share of overall value rose in the aftermath of those pandemics. And you know, there are various reasons for that. You know, some pandemics were so brutal that there were just fewer workers and you had a labor shortage, a real labor shortage, and people could command more money for their work. But there is something to the psychological nature of it, this reassessment that people have of you know, what they want out of life and their job, that I do think plays a role in it.
Sure. But now we're looking at record low unemployment numbers. Right. The numbers that just came out on Friday are, you know, I think the lowest job claims, except for 1 week since they've kept records. Like that was back in 1960 something, when there were the job seeking population was much smaller. So there's a lot to be. Is it just that people are not looking for jobs, or we are at such employment levels that I guess anybody who needs a job can get one, allegedly?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of factors that I think go into the low unemployment numbers. I mean, obviously, we had a tremendous recovery out of the pandemic, and a lot of that was because we used fiscal spending power to give people a leg up and make sure they weren't left behind. And unlike the Great Recession, where we spent years to get back to our employment levels, this time it was very, very rapid. And so you have that, and then you have certain combinations that have lowered, like the level of the overall workforce. One is very low immigration over the last 3 or 4 years, because of Trump cruelty, frankly, and also the order at the border that allowed migrants to be expelled without a hearing, called Title 42. It was allegedly a pandemic safety response,
which Biden just overturned.
Doesn't really work that way. Well, he's trying to. Oh. He said it would end on May 23rd. But there's now, a furious pushback in Congress from Republicans as well as some Democrats. And it is I'm going to have a piece on this out tomorrow, actually. This has played into the funding for pandemic response.
Right.
This $10 billion that they're trying to get
for vaccines.
That started as
$24 billion.
Yeah, but now it's down to 10 for vaccines and tests and therapeutics. And it was stopped last week because Republicans wanted an amendment to extend this Title 42 order at the border. And many Democrats support them on that. Maggie Hassan, people in tough races like Reverend Warnock even has spoken against canceling Title 42. Mark Kelly, Sinema Manchin, of course. Immigration as sort of a proxy issue is now playing into whether or not we get this pandemic response money, which is crucial, because if there's another outbreak, we do not have the structure in place to deal with it.
Right. Yeah. And
so anyway, immigration is a factor. In addition, in terms of the size of the workforce, there was an elevated amount of retirements. There's been a very large boom in people self-employing, in people starting their own businesses. And so you do have this sort of somewhat of a shrunken level of the workforce. And also, you know, because the economy is running pretty well, you have people able to say, I'm going to shift jobs. I'm going to move up the ladder. I'm going to find a better situation for
right.
myself.
But, you know, David Dayen, you just a couple of times in that last segment, you were talking about how the recovery is great. The economy is doing really well. If you listen to the corporate news media, which is dominated by Fox and right-wing voices, it seems, the economy is horrible. Things are terrible. Yes, we have high inflation and gas prices are high. But one thing the media doesn't say is that's all over the world. It's not just here. Our economy is, in fact, doing well, even though some of us are still hurting. How do we bring out the level of disinformation that's being put out on a daily basis and being presented as if it's news?
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem. I want to be clear that when workers' real wages fall, they generally are pretty unhappy about that. If the amount of money that it costs you to get, you know, your basic necessities is suddenly so much more that even if you get a raise, it doesn't counteract that, you're not going to feel too good about that. Sure. And that's what we've seen over the last several months as inflation has spiked. And so there are reasons to believe this. Also, the first quarter GDP numbers are coming in just about flat. We've kind of had our boom. We put a lot of resources into the economy. It's things like the child tax credit that then expired.
Right.
All of the stuff from the American Rescue Plan was short term, and now it's expired and it's done. And so there are no more sort of props holding up the economy and helping out. And fiscal policy has kind of turned negative. Uh-huh. And in addition, you have this inflation measure, which largely is a function of broken supply chains. And also now, as a secondary factor, the war, which is causing a rise in particularly energy prices. Mm-hmm. So there are challenges in this economy. Oh, there's no question.
Lots of them. But it's not the fundamental. It's outside issues that are hurting it. I you can tell I'm not an economist.
I mean, there certainly is an imbalance in how the economy is talked about. There is less focus on the record amount of jobs that are being created, the lowest unemployment in 50 years plus, et cetera, and much more focus on inflation, which is also at a 40-year high.
Right.
And we've definitely focused on one of those things much more over another. The question is, how do you regain that balance? How do you give a credible picture of what is happening in the economy?
Yeah, that's the $64 zillion question, though.
Right.
And you, as the executive editor of the American Prospect, that's got to be something you struggle with a lot because of the amount of, I guess, pushback you have to do against dishonest actors in the so-called news industry. There's so much bullshit being put out there every day that do you have to spend a lot of your time disproving what they're saying is fact?
Well, we do a media column every Friday by Eric Alterman, and we're just inaugurating a new feature. Speaking of dishonest actors, called Summers Watch, which will just take a look at Larry Summers' statements and try to find the kernels of truth in there if we can. We're rolling out some things on that front that attempt to give a greater picture. But, I think our role is to try to inform people as to what's really happening in our economy and who's responsible. There's one kind of level of thought that this is about the large spending that was done in the American Rescue Plan is responsible for the high inflation. And the thing that we focus on is the fact that, no, we have these not just supply chain issues, but what large corporations are doing sort of in an opportunistic way to take advantage of inflation, to raise prices and pad their profits. Mm-hmm. We look at how energy prices have risen through, you know, because of the war, and how, you know, investors on Wall Street want to keep those profits going. And so they don't want to produce any more energy so that they can maintain those level of profits and those high prices. There are all sorts of ways to kind of explain, you know, what is actually happening and how it affects you. And I think that's what we like to focus on.
And you guys do a great job. There's always a wealth of information there, and more than, you know, more than your standard headlines. You guys dig in, and you do great reporting. David Dan, always appreciate it. Find them at prospect.org, on the Twitters at The Prospect. David Dan's on Twitter at ddan, and here whenever I can convince him to come on. I try not to ask too often because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to overstep my welcome here, but I always appreciate when you do. Thank you so much, Dave. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your work.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Right. Take care. Bye-bye. And that's it today. Tomorrow, John Bonifaz is going to be here. He is, he's with a number of different groups, but I think this time he's representing Free Speech for People. And what they're doing is challenging the right of some politicians who have participated in, insurrectionist type activities, of their right to run for office again. So, you know, think Marjorie Q. Greene, think Madison Cawthorn, you know, think the dregs of the earth. And we'll talk with John Bonifaz tomorrow and see what's up. So that's it. Thank you for listening. There's so much we didn't get to because that's the way of the world these days. Don't forget, if you want to enclose a note to Tanya, email it to me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com. I'll print them out, put them in with the package that I'm sending, and maybe we can just brighten her day a little bit. All right? Okay, I'll see you tomorrow, and I'll leave you with the news. Thanks for listening, everybody, as I lose my voice. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, the Russians are again amassing forces, this time focused in eastern Ukraine, as Western and Ukrainian officials warn a major assault on the region is imminent. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country is ready for an offensive, but he urged civilians to evacuate the region. But many people are getting trapped in areas of fighting where access to some towns is being blocked by Russian forces. 9 new evacuation corridors were agreed on Sunday, that following a deadly Russian missile attack last week that hit a train station packed with thousands of evacuees. Meanwhile, in Russia, Putin is maintaining his heavy-handed approach. He recently appointed a new general to direct the war in Ukraine after his troops failed to take the city of Kyiv. This new general is the same one who directed horrific attacks on civilians in Syria. President Zelensky continues appealing to the international community for help. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson visited Kyiv over the weekend, appearing publicly with President Zelensky. The Ukrainian president also sat for an interview with 60 Minutes. Among other things, he explained how Putin is guilty of war crimes.
The Ukrainian security service has intercepted communications, he told us. There are Russian soldiers talking to their parents about what they stole and who they abducted. There are recordings of Russian prisoners of war who admitted to killing people. There are pilots in prison who had maps with civilian targets to bomb. There are also investigations being conducted based on the remains of the dead.
Should Vladimir Putin be prosecuted for war crimes?
Look, I think everyone who made a decision, who issued an order, who fulfilled an order, everyone who is relevant to this, I believe they are guilty.
Do you hold Putin responsible? I do believe he's one of them.
At least 72 people now are known to have contracted COVID-19 after attending the Gridiron Dinner in Washington, D.C. last week. Among them, several cabinet members, Attorney General Merrick Garland, Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, and now Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. Lawmakers, including Representatives Joaquin Castro, Adam Schiff, Peter DeFazio, and Angie Craig, Senators Raphael Warnock and Susan Collins, and the latest to test positive, New York City Mayor Eric Adams. And, oh yeah, a whole bunch of journalists. Also testing positive were Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, though neither of them were at that event. COVID's not over, just saying. It was another deadly weekend across the country thanks to our obsession with guns. Here's a sampling from the world's most trigger-happy country. Four people, including two teenagers, were shot after a Major League Baseball game in Washington, D.C. Saturday night. Six people were injured in Illinois in a shooting in a residential neighborhood. In Indianapolis, six were shot, one killed at a shooting at a birthday party. And two people were killed and another 10 hospitalized after a, quote, targeted attack at a nightclub in Cedar Rapids. President Biden is expected to announce a new firearm regulation as soon as Monday, meant to contain the use of privately made weapons known as ghost guns. They are both unregulated and untraceable. And as if that wasn't enough, from the Are You Effing Kidding Me files, on Friday, a federal jury acquitted two of the defendants who were accused of conspiring to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. The jury was unable to reach a verdict on the other two had been charged. This after two others who took a deal and pleaded guilty and are reportedly now kicking themselves. The case appeared to be a slam dunk, and unfortunately, that's how the prosecution treated it. The defense, meanwhile, exposed their clients as virtual idiots who couldn't have pulled off a kidnapping to save their lives and claimed it was all an FBI entrapment scheme. The jury obviously bought it. Both before and during the trial, prosecutors went to great lengths to exclude evidence and witnesses that might undermine their arguments while winning the right to bring in almost anything that was favorable to their side. Those tactics are being questioned now as part of a growing conception of government overreach that many are pointing to in this acquittal. Well, the effects of the expected reversal of the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Roe v. Wade has led many Republican states to chomp at the bit once again to outlaw women's right to choose what happens with their own bodies. Texas was the first to enact a new, seemingly unconstitutional abortion ban after just 6 weeks of pregnancy, and had actually arrested a woman because of her, quote, self-induced abortion. Well, now the Starr County, Texas District Attorney's Office said it was dropping murder charges against 26-year-old Lizelle Herrera. They issued a statement saying that Herrera was charged for, quote, intentionally and knowingly causing the death of an individual by self-induced abortion. Activists on both sides of the debate were unsure what law Herrera was being accused of violating. Despite all that the Republicans have done to overturn Roe, the procedure is still legal. The district attorney's office said the case was, quote, not a criminal matter. For now, anyway. Twitizens, relax. Tesla CEO Elon Musk has decided not to join Twitter's board. Just a week ago, Twitter had said in a regulatory filing that Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla and SpaceX, who recently bought a 9% stake in Twitter, would join the board. Well, the company announced the reversal over the weekend, with Twitter's new CEO saying it was for the best, but he warned of distractions ahead, adding that Musk is, quote, our biggest shareholder, and we will remain open to his input. Okay. And finally, the people of France went to the polls this weekend for the first part of their presidential election. Out of 12 candidates who ran, the top two, who are expected to advance to the second round, are the same two who faced off in 2017. Current President Emmanuel Macron and far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. Macron with 28.6% of the vote versus 23.6% for Le Pen. They'll face off in a runoff on April 24th. My favorite tweet this morning was from an author, a guy named Gary Stenjugart, who wrote, Dear France, we love you.
don't F this up like we did. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.